something that I've taken from Barry Truax, who says, in Western culture, music is now taken out of its environmental context and separated. This could be by the privileged and sort of fancy performance spaces, and by commodification and commercial uses. And do you think this is changing now? Or do you think it's still like this, or is it getting worse?
So from when is that quote?
This quote is from 2012.
When I think there's a change happening because of the young generation, they're looking for something different. But I also, I mean, I come in the same vein. I also said in the West, music was made a commodity, that it's used as a product, yeah? Mm-hmm. As a product which can be consumed. And so in that way, when you want the product, everything comes with it, so that it's nicely packaged and it's rationed and it's marketed and okay. It's branded and all of that. Let's say as a contrast, you take it, we had last week, you might have been here when we had those tribal folk here.
Yeah.
Yeah, from the mountains. You know, in tribal societies, and I lived for quite a few years with indigenous people, mm-hmm. with the Maoris, with Aborigines, in Papua New Guinea, in the South Pacific Islands. Music is very much part of life. There's almost no separation between music and life. You know, it's there when people are working, when they're meeting, when they're mm-hmm. Eating, when they're relaxing. In all circumstances, you have music available. And I think if I more, you know, with, now I'm talking about my journey since the 60s in the West, there was definitely this process of music becoming specialized, you know.
Yeah.
Because in those traditional societies, music was also, how to say, there were also no specialist musicians, basically. In the tribe, everybody could drum, mm-hmm. or everybody could play the flute, or they changed, okay? You had maybe some specialists, like the music man, or sure. something, or the medicine man. But also interesting that music was used then kind of like as medicine, as weather, for the weatherman, for mm-hmm. celebrations, for rituals and all of that. And that's what we mean when we say in the West, it's specialized, and it was basically became integrated or commodified in the consumerist, materialistic mm-hmm. product society.
And it was kind of glamorized.
Yeah, also, and specialized. And then you had the hero's journey was a different chapter, and it belonged to a few, and they were specialized, you know, mm-hmm. they became sure. specialized, and you had then the stars, and only they could make music. You were asking, is it changing?
Yes.
You know, one thing which is definitely changing amazingly, like from my time when I went to music school, and nowadays when I see the young people who are coming here, in my time it was very rare that you had a musician who actually played two instruments. Mm-hmm. You know, usually you had a guitar, you were on the flutes, or you were on the percussion, or in whichever things, or on the bowed instruments. Nowadays, most of the musicians, I mean the young people, that's why I think something else is happening. Away from the specialist, and to maybe also through this movement of world music, listening, you know, that was a fascinating thing of the media. Because we were still dependent, on radio. Radio was a fabulous thing. We grew up listening, my generation,
yeah.
before TV came in.
We didn't really do that anymore with radio.
Yeah,
anymore.
Exactly. Yeah. But also it brought the gifts from, how to say, from music from all over the world. And then we heard, you know, lots of the music from Africa, mm-hmm. South America. It's all communal music. So I think that helped in one way. They come in, and then when the drum circle started in the Western universities and all of that, hey, it's like we want to make music. We don't only want to listen to sure. the specialists and go to expensive concerts. Mm-hmm. I think that would change a lot. Any more young people want to do it, want to be part of it.
So the whole specialist thing is maybe...
Definitely. That's strongly morphing since 15 years.
Yeah. Few philosophers currently who are claiming that nature, the term nature, is a man-made term that separates, you know, we're putting nature on a pedestal and we're being like, something else, and look at this. Mm-hmm. It's objectified.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think sound therapy or instrument making can attest to this claim? You know, can it? Does it agree with it? Does it deal with it in any way?
I think what music actually really, or if you work deeper with sound, it's almost like a paradigm shift in this whole objectivation of reality, or that split in subject and object is disappearing, because you realize that, how to say, depending, you influence your hearing experience to where you add and how you add and. Mm-hmm. And you realize actually also, I think in the work I'm offering on sound therapy, is that we are regaining the capacity of deeper listening. That means from maybe, my teacher always said, from a 2000 years focus on the visual experience, and maybe the visual, as he said, the visual actually, the emphasis on the visual, helps to build the two brain hemispheres.
Sure.
Yeah. And the oral sense is completely different sense. You can say it's like the feminine bound down to the male visual experience. And I think the deeper you go into listening, the more you understand, you dive into this vibrational, layer or perspective of reality. Mm-hmm. And then you realize it has vibrations outside, and it's always fluid, and everything is moving and constantly shifting and changing, but the same thing is happening inside.
Right.
Yeah. And so, and then I think, instead of what you mentioned earlier, this split in here and there and outside and inside, I think in the listening, that's the paradigm shift, that you realize, hey, it's all a unified field. And you, of course, you can, you know, that we have a young sound engineer here, and we had a TEDx happening a few weeks ago, and he spoke about it, that he was so fascinated as a kid through listening, and then he wanted to really understand how the songs are made, and then he went into sound engineering and into the industry and production, and he said at one point he lost music, because he was analyzing all the sounds and kind of like playing with them and figuring them and all of that, and he said suddenly he lost music, and what brought him back was exactly what you had said before from your memory, was actually the sound of the wind chime, which was kind of like just happening, and suddenly he said, oh, maybe this is music.
Sure.
Where the elements and the wind is actually making the music, and it's not predetermined, it's not made, and there's no willpower in it. Mm-hmm. And so on that question, basically, I say that's exactly what we are looking forward in, what's this great adventure. And I think that need in the young generation, opening more and more again to the oral sense and to a musical sound experience, is that with that longing there of not only perceiving but living in a unified field.
So, on a kind of art of listening, so you can listen in different ways, you can listen to one level of a song or a piece of music, you can concentrate on some harmonies, and therefore you will only hear those harmonies, and everything else kind of sinks to the background. But when you make music, you're actually demonstrating or exhibiting to other people how you listen to music. And is this something that you want to teach with to try and impact how people can make music from the way in which they listen to it?
I think that's the, you're hitting it, because the first thing actually in making music is of course listening.
Yeah.
Now maybe I had been in classical music, but then I spent many years in a contemplative tradition which was all about listening.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so in that way I said I had the good fortune of actually going back into elementary school and start from the beginning, because it's astounding for me. I have many people visiting here who play in symphony orchestras and stuff.
Play what?
In symphony orchestras.
Right.
And they're completely stressed and frustrated. It's a job, and they're super high-strung, competition and all of that. And then they are happy when they, as, again, when they just listen to some, when we sit here and they can listen to the wind or something like that. So, I think when you ask also how listening informs your music, for instance, I've been with some of my colleagues, we can only, you know, we play in kind of like open space, improvisation, avant-garde sound environment. The precondition is in those groups is we can only start from silence. The quality of those improvisations is informed by the quality of the silence before. Mm-hmm. If there's a good listening space and then you enter an improvisation, then really you stay with it. You stay with the alertness and you go through, you go in an adventure and everybody's part of it. For many years I couldn't go to jam sessions, you know, which were just like, you know, where people want to express themselves and want to forget themselves, because I missed the quality of listening, because it was more like at that time, it was more like expressing your feeling, your frustrations or your happiness or your joy. But in the way it was really on our side, it was more like a cultivation of listening to each other. Uh-huh. Listening to the space, listening to the moment, listening to what's going on, and then actually again there is no separation too, because you're listening, inevitably you are part of the listening. Mm-hmm. So you're listening to yourself, and then what you express in music is influenced by how deep you're actually listening to yourself. So silence is for me, it's a precondition for good music. And you know what, that's what I think was the gift of people like John Cage. Even you had all this avant-garde music and the awakening of the electronic and all of that. And there's this beautiful anecdote where John Cage spent kind of like 8 hours in the studio, and then he was walking home in New York and he passed this gutter.
It's what, sorry?
Gutter.
Oh, gutter.
Gutter in the street. Uh-huh. And then he basically heard, you know, he heard the water running in the gutter. And he just stood there and he's, oh my God, you know what, that's something which I have missed in the studio. It was not there. This immediacy, this freshness, this discovery moment. I think the awe of being completely in the moment, and this is happening right now. So often, for me as an alternative to the normal improvisation, I always mention, I said, let's do the Zen one. That means that there was actually no predetermined structure. There was no melodic structure, there was no rhythmic structure. And anything could happen from moment to moment. And I think that's the delight of any ensemble playing, when people come into such a deep space of synchronization. Mm-hmm. And that can only happen when there is a deep listening to each other. Even if it's with, you know, electro guitars and stuff like this, and you and a friend, see, but you still kind of like, you still know what's happening on the trams and stuff.
So, there's a traumatologist called Bessel van der Kolk. Mm-hmm. He stated that memory is in itself a sensual experience, in itself. Me personally, my most notable experiences of music or sound have been when they've triggered something that's been a memory. And it's been that experience over the actual me being there in place and time that has been particularly had the biggest effect on me. Do you know the story of Edgard Varese when he got to New York and he heard above the din of all of the traffic and and everything, the city noise, he heard this resonant frequency that he'd heard throughout his whole childhood. And it kind of went like that, and it was like a very notable thing for him. It's kind of a crazy example. But is it that we are kind of sometimes haunted by the need to recapture these stimuli that we perhaps have heard? And, you know,
the first thing is, I think with listening we have a chance of looking for the mystery of life, for the unknown. You know, we are all geared into seeing, and we learn to orientate ourselves pretty quickly, and we make sense of our environment, most of us. I mean, there are some kids who don't manage, you know, in the autistic spectrum and all of that. But basically, we orientate ourselves through seeing, very much so. Yeah? And I mean, it's very beautiful. I spend some time sometimes with blind people. They have a completely different sense and perception of life because they orientate themselves through listening. And so I'm saying that in keeping the ears open or in wanting to recapture some of those experiences or reconnect, it's like a little bit of like hunting to the mystery and the unknown. I think that's at the core of what life is, in one way. And you see, when I stayed in the bush, or especially in the jungle, with indigenous people, the ear is so much more, I cannot say, but it definitely has a completely different placement than the eye, because you, with the eye, you cannot see far. You see just green around you. But with the ear, you can discern who is in the neighborhood, which animals, in which mood they are, what is the movement of it. Yeah. So again, we come to the kind of like a unique oral sense, and it's reawakening. I think in sound therapy, like in any therapy, it's all about coming into awareness of what's going on.
Okay.
Yeah, usually, let's say, all suffering is kind of like, it's there through where energy doesn't flow, where there's a blockage, can be through traumatic experiences or whatever, and basically to understand how it came to it, or what blocks, actually, it's how can you get into a flow, and that getting into flow can in one way happen, let's say, in through forgetting yourself and forgetting the thinking, so that you abide and get into an alpha state or something. Where that's one part of receptive sound therapy. The people just, how to say, the brain slows down, and you're not in thought, you're in the sensory perception. You will see it tomorrow when you're in that sound bath. I'll introduce the people, how to say, a bit of it, you know, so that they are present in their body. When the mind is occupied with what's happening on a sensational level, it can let the thinking behind. And then you come into a momentary awareness, and then when you're in the moment, everything is possible. In the moment, you can have, how would you call it then? It's not a déjà vu or something.
Sure, yeah. Something gets triggered.
Yeah, yeah. You get triggered into some stuff which might not even be that you can remember it from this life.
Okay.
That you think, wow, you enter into that zone. Where is that one coming from?
Yeah.
And there again, I think because the listening experience is not bound by matter. It's not bound by physical matter. I mean, it's a happening in the air molecules and stuff like this, but let's say in the Indian system, we say listening is a sense of ether, of akash. You know, you want to understand matter, you smell it, you taste it, and all the different elements, light, you see it. Listening is actually the sense opening into ether. So what is that? What is it? You cannot grasp it. You cannot feel it. You can sense it, but you're listening into it. So now we have this drum starting. It's very earthy sound, but it still kind of like conveys something through vibration. And in the vibrational dimension, we are very fluid. In the time, you know, that's what I'm saying. Often in therapy, things come up where people have no clue that was ever happening in their life. And if that's not happening, people go into inner landscapes. That's for me the fun in the sound journey. Mm-hmm. People travel into landscapes, either from the past or from the future. So we might have to move, because the kids had an instrument building course for the whole afternoon, and now they are basically bringing their energies together. But you see that in there you realize, in seeing is, how to say, in seeing we're often also not conscious unless you practice it as a contemplative practice. I think, you know, why is in all the contemplative practices listening in the foreground?
Sure.
Is in Buddhism, in Hinduism, in Sufism, in Judaism, or wherever. It's all about listening. So that listening is definitely bringing us into a different dimension.
Okay.
Of our reality,
right.
You can say. And I say it brings us into the vibrational dimension. Mm-hmm. And so it brings us also into an experience. And our experience, as you said in this initial quote, actually, it's very funny. Experience is, it's kind of like a conglomeration of memories. I don't know the theory of it. Mm-hmm. But our experience is built on memories.
Mm-hmm.
And we learn through experience, and while we experience, actually part of it is stored, and it evolves and it grows.
Sure.
And so that's why we have kind of like, you hear a sound as you did before, mm-hmm. and you immediately have a memory.
Yeah.
And I think, but let's say part of the practice of listening is to that it can really bring you into a momentary awareness.
Yes. Yeah?
You might, a memory might flash up, yeah, and you might be carried away for some time, but then it's again, because it's not only the wind chime sound, you have the machine sound, you have this sound, and you have all those things going on.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, listening has to do something with awakening.
Okay. So you mentioned about staying with the people in the forest, these mm-hmm. indigenous people, and they're perhaps more fine-tuned with their ears, because they live in these hi-fi soundscapes, which is a landscape untampered by industry.
Yes.
Or
you spread your ears for 5 kilometers.
Right.
Survival depends on listening.
Right, exactly, yeah. To that extent. So do you think that, obviously that's a cultural thing, that they, you know, they listen differently because they have to, because they live in these environments. So different states of awareness, examples are sleeping, meditating,
yeah.
or being fully awake. The brain functions at different frequencies. Right?
Yes.
And we're able to sort of tap into this with things like sound and sound therapy. I guess that's kind of crudely put, but do you think as humans we resonate to a common and universal frequency? Because I'd like to think we did. Or is it cultural?
Well, I think, I mean, my search is also on universals. What are the universals behind it all? Yeah, what's the basic drone of the planet zooming through space and stuff? Now, there's one thing, what you touched earlier, is there different evolutionary stages of our human journey.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in different stages, listening took a different place, you know, in an archaic society or in a magic society or in a mystic society. I think in the mental framework, definitely, as I mentioned before, the seeing created, I think, created the mentality and created the functioning of discernment and objectivization, you know. So there are those different layers. There are those different layers in humanity. And let's say when you stay with tribals and you stay in nature, of course you're in a complete deep listening space.
Mm-hmm.
And and especially in the jungle, because usually the jungle awakes in the night.
Sure.
You know, you don't see anything, it's kind of pitch dark, and then kind of like you have this amazing orchestration of all possible sounds which you've never heard in your life before. Quite freaky it can be also. And so how does it be? The great thing is also, for instance, in that incense, they can discern, or you learn to discern also distances. So you have a... I'm not saying that in listening you get go into this dream space. That's a fascinating thing, that in listening you can be also very alert, super alert also. Yeah? So it's I think actually, again, it's an integration space. And so when I talked about the archaic, the magic, that Jean Gebser, or, you know, evolutionary theories, and then we said, okay, now we were all going through our mental development, and now maybe, hopefully, I think in the young generation there's much more signs of it. But there's an urge and a need, I think, for humanity to come into an integrated state of consciousness. That's why I think also listening is coming back stronger in our awareness. You know, there was this research which I was kind of like associated with in the 70s, recapturing the music of the spheres. What was it that Pythagoras was listening to? And some of the mystics were talking about it. So then the research with psychedelics and all of that. And then this, through Kepler studies, they said, oh, you know, this is the planetary frequency. That's the motion around the planet, around the sun. That's a specific frequency. You octavize it and you come to an audible frequency.
Yeah.
And then they wanted to verify it. They said, okay, you know what, it's a C and it's not a C sharp. Or so it's between a C and C sharp, that specific frequency, yeah? When you had it in a listening range. And then it so happened that some of those folks were associated with Indian music, and the checked with Ravi Shankar and some of the musicians, and they asked him, what's the drone and how does it tune his sitar? And he said, well, actually, you know, that's changeable. It depends on the season. And an Indian singer tuning his tambura, you know, some days he feels his voice sits deeper, and then he tunes it deeper. There's no fixed pitch. But the fascinating thing was this image that Ravi Shankar said, well, it's between a C and a C sharp, and it's neither one of them. And that was exactly what that frequency was, of the basic movement of the Earth around the Sun, which is a kind of like an approximation, because there's different speeds. But that was a beautiful image, that we had this image, we said, you know what, the Indian rishis, or how do you say, the singers, they sit anywhere on the floor, how do you say, with the coccyx connected to the to the ground, and in the vertical, and they had an intuitive sense of the buzzing sound of the Earth in the solar system. It was just an image, because you were asking for those universals, and then we have things like the Schumann resonance. You know what? Then we it's this frequency, what, around between 7 and 8 hertz, which is happening, I think, between the Earth's magnetosphere and the ionosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's morphing, it's changing, but there's somehow a constant. Yeah, and many young people come here and they say, hey, what about this one? Is this the sound of the Earth? And stuff like this. Then I always say, yeah, it might be. That might be one of the basic buzzes. But we also, again, we want to fix it and hold it in one specific framework. And you know what? Everything in nature is moving, is breathing, is expanding and contracting, is speeding up and slowing down. And to fix it on one specific frequency, that would be... It's not happening in nature. It's the same thing when you look at this whole huge question of natural tunings and temperament. Yeah, and fascinating, if you look at it as a metaphor, basically music is an open system. If you work the pure harmonic series or something like this, it doesn't make a circle. Or even if you take one interval like the pure fifth and you want to build a tonal system, you come back after 12th, fifth to basically the same note, but you're not hitting it right away, you go beyond it. So music is spiraling. And that was, how to say, I diverted now, but the whole movement of temperament was like, you cannot harness it when it's spiraling, because you cannot transpose them from one note to another. So, because it's, when it's an open system, it's also hierarchical. You have a center of the galaxy. You have different arms in the periphery of it, but for the Western music system, and that was part also of the rationalization. We said, hey, let's fix it. Let's fix the system.
Yeah. And so with the spiral, that's why it has to be transient, and that's why it has to be locked into memory, and that's why you can't exactly harness it.
Even when people want to fix the Schumann resonance and say, oh, finally we found it, this is the resonance in the planet, and then they find out that over the last 15 years it morphed and it raised.
Yeah.
So what's happening on the planet? Is something speeding up, or are we all getting nervous, or why? What is that movement that even the concert pitch is constantly changed? You know, it's rising. What's that? So where are those universal constants? We know that even the sun activities is not constant. It has its cycles.
Yeah,
you know, and it moves. And in one way, so the eye and the logic comes to its limitations, because it wants to fix it and write those constants and stuff like this. I mean, I'm saying it now in a metaphor way. If you go through a listening sense, that doesn't matter so much, because you're morphing from moment to moment.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to be with what is, and what your experience is, and what your memory told you, and maybe what the unknown is ushering you into. Sounds a bit esoteric, all, but I think that's the deeper you go into listening, it opens those other layers which we cannot class with language and logic. I mean, part of your work, how this is studying it, is, yeah, we want to explore it. We want to put some stakes on the path in the jungle, that we find the path back again,
mm-hmm.
you know, that we don't lose our way and stuff. So I'm taking that privilege and say, I'm happy to stay in that mystic space of it.
So in a way, it's best not to demystify these things.
Both ways, I think is good. You know, what's this English the soundman from London who travels all over the world and does the recordings of these most amazing acoustic spaces? Trevor Cox.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah?
I heard him on the BBC before, actually.
Yeah. So, let's say, it makes it delightful if we can, the mysticism of it is the pure experience of it.
Sure.
And maybe that just can be left as it is. But
right.
of course, when we are in waking consciousness, and then you want to understand, how is it happening, what is it happening? So he, for instance, in his travel log, going to this most amazing acoustic places on the planet, he talks first about the experience of it. You know, it brings you into that space,
right.
But then it makes it double delightful, because he talks about the acoustics of it and the measurements, and because he comes from the acoustic field and worked it out. So I think that
he's able to separate.
Yes, but I think, you know what? When I talk about an integrated or integral consciousness, that's what we're looking for. In one way, is have an experience, but leave it in its own right, but have all the delight and fun of dissecting it and explaining it. But the thing is, entering in the fluidity of the vibrational dimension of life, we don't have the tools often.
Okay.
Yeah? And so we would have maybe the tools if we really would understand if we approach it from a quantum perspective. Because then you come into an interrelated universe. Then you come into kind of like a non-locality. Then you come into, what do they call it, downward causation. Then everything has place. The material plane has a place. The subtle plane has one. The experience, your subjectivity, everything has a place in it. And I think that's, again, where sound awareness is leading us. It leads us into a new space of integration. And I think we need quantum science for it. If we really want to kind of like take it apart and say, this is how it's happening. That's it. Yeah, this is a West African rhythm.
I recognize this from the other evening.
It's Belgian drum teacher. I think they played that same. It's fascinating, you know, for instance, they have he knows about 25, 30 rhythms from West Africa. He lived there. And each one has a different communal function. One of them is kind of like honoring the elders. Another one is encouraging the woman. Another one is energizing the youth. Another one is kind of like establishing authority of the main warrior and stuff like this. So that means, again, how to say there, I think in the perception, if you would put yourself into that tribal skin, when they hear a rhythm like this, it's not only that they hear a specific rhythm and you can say, hey, what is it? It's okay, it's a straight four or something like this, you count on it. But they see images, it's inculturated. They have a complete experience of just listening to a rhythm.
Yeah.
They might associate it even with a specific food on that occasion or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's like a total experience.
Sure. Trying to translate a feeling or emotion into sound or noise, for example, if you're a songwriter, can sound, I guess not sound therapy, but just constant interaction with instruments and perhaps making instruments as well, because you have a kind of hands-on thing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that in itself can help to fabricate whatever it is that you're trying to fabricate?
You mentioned now for the third time, and I didn't respond on actually in the core what we're doing here is instrument making.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I have like in 2 weeks there's this top neurosurgeon coming, who also is working with sound and is using music and all of that from Mumbai.
And he's a neurosurgeon.
Yeah, but he uses color and sound and all of that. He's an amazing doctor. And so he took some instruments from our side, but he also was making instruments. We sometimes have instrument making courses and stuff like this. So he said that instruments which he made himself, he can express himself. He has such a different relation. And that's what most of the people say. I have a friend in Switzerland who is teaching music therapy, and he has actually instrument making courses for music therapists.
Oh, really?
Yes, because when you make an instrument, you relate to it in a complete different way.
Mm-hmm.
And people actually, that was surprising for me. He just wrote me 2 weeks ago and he said, listen, can I come actually? I want to make a few more instruments because with these instruments I made myself, I can go much deeper with the client. So I cannot even say what it is. Is it because maybe you see the magic of making instruments is that you work with apparently dead, cool material, yeah? And you fit it together and you know the mathematics of it, or you're just carving on it and all of that. And actually at one point in the process, there's a sound coming out. Vibration happening. So we see actually that's a beautiful thing which I learned in India and in the shamanistic tradition you have it also, that instruments actually they have something of a beingness. Instruments are not objects like other objects. They are objects which are containers for life and for life energy. Yeah. So and I think if you are in the process of making that and you have some good moments with it, then basically it's like almost like giving life to matter. It's the same thing when I made my first ocarina, you know, ocarinas are made just from clay. Mm-hmm. So I went to a river and I took the clay, the soil, and I mixed it and kneaded it, had it dried a little bit in the sun. Then you form it in your hands, and then you start to work on the labium, you know, on the air channel and stuff like this. And you have this lump of clay. Mm-hmm. And then kind of like you start...
Literally the earth.
Yeah. And then you blow into it, and suddenly, and there's a vibration which resonates, maybe even in a certain part of your body.
Yeah.
It's beautiful process mm-hmm. of it. And you know what, with those tribals whom we had here last week, they actually, it was the first time that they made instruments in the open, because for them it's a secret process. And they might take months for it to make a try. I was completely astounded. I didn't know that story.
Yeah.
Because for them it's almost like a spirit work.
Hmm.
We know that from shamanistic tradition. So coming back to your question, yes, you can, when you're, there is this other element in music, in an instrument. Yeah? It can basically, it can sing. Can resonate. If you're part of the process of seeing the birth of that, that definitely influences your attitude then probably towards that instrument. And imagine this is your playground instead of swings and building blocks and stuff like this. Imagine how naturally you can handle those toys. And then when you have actually the need, that's what you started off with, from a feeling, emotion, you want to express something, you know your instruments, you know what you need, you know what you take. I think that's also maybe in one way why specialization was necessary. You know, because if you, how to say, you, on the guitar it's fairly easy, you learn a few chords and stuff like this, and you can play songs, but if you maybe really want to express some deeper layer, you have to, of course, get to know this instrument. And it works best if the instrument is almost like part of your lips or part of your hands and fingers. Then actually, the how to say, whatever is there which wants to be expressed, it just can flow through. And that's what musicians also, you experience, basically, when you really go into it, there's no... The instrument is part of... We speak about the human instrumentation. You know, the body is an instrument, and the music instrument is just an extension of it. What you said initially, you know, that so many young people, they want to be able to express or use different instruments, musical instruments, maybe also because the need is there, because life is so complex and so rich, and we go through so many... ups and downs, and is in our urban Western environment and all of that. And so I think we touch so many different layers, and possibly that if you play just silver flute might not be enough to express what all those things which are going on.
Right. So I was informed by one of my colleagues that you grew up near ley lines, a hotspot of ley lines, and I kind of did too as well, in between Glastonbury and Stonehenge,
yeah.
So the Salisbury Plains.
Yeah.
What effects on the senses do you think these places have, these significant hotspots for the energy?
Very beautiful that you come to that one. We talked about listening and kind of like heightening that sense of listening. I think listening, what we speak about it, it's just actually like an entry gate. Mm. I actually take at this moment, badly, this work which we're doing, if I put it in the context of yoga and transformation of the body and of the species and all, evolution of the species, I see actually that music is coming back to its original source. Music is like a gateway, I mentioned it before, a gateway into the unseen, unknown territory of our existence. And I'm actually have this image or a sense of it, and the hope that instruments will be created, hopefully here, even within the, even in my lifetime, the next 15, 20 years, if there's still time, that instruments are created which are not there per se to make music, but which help us to sensitize our being and kind of like harness deeper and more finer senses, so that we would be also able to cage ley lines and things like this.
Okay.
And in one way, I think that's what's happening, you know, when they speak about, how to say, change of grade on the planet and stuff like this, or a different activity of from the solar center. It seems that our brain anyway, one function of the brain is that it actually protects us from too much of impact, because we would go crazy. Imagine if we would be able to listen to all the microwaves which are flying through the air in urban environments or stuff like this. Or I find it also fascinating, why is the hearing range only starting with 16 hertz, where you can say, and the brain waves, they work on that range.
Exactly.
And how many people have, what do you call it, tinnitus?
Tinnitus.
So that's because there's different layers opening. So we are protected, but it seems so. We are in a process, I think, in the evolution of the spaces, where we are opening a new sensitivity. And the sense of listening is the entry gate. As I said, it's the entry gate, the portal also into etheric layer of it. You know, you have the earth layer, let's say the earth element, you can touch the things, you have the fluidity, you have the gaseous stage. What's ether? It's the subtle. So I think part of our work, knowing it or not knowing it, it's somehow happening, and this whole urge of the young generation and this explosion of interest into sound healing, it's all, I think, that need, or something is happening, that we open into finer layers.
Mm-hmm.
And then when this is happening, then we can speak. Some people have the capacity of dowsing and all of that, but I think that the more we open into that dimension, the more it will happen. And so playing with sound and this whole rap of awareness and all of that, I think that's what it's leading to.
Okay. There was a guy who came here, I think, a couple of years ago, who you'll know. It's called Marko Bukacnik.
Yeah, yeah.
And he does...
This year he was here, yeah.
This year was it.
He does earth acupuncture.
That's it. Lithopuncture,
yeah.
He calls it. And I saw this today, he calls it geomancy.
Yeah, yeah.
Harnessing
and knowing about the forces in nature.
Right.
And he's a specialist. He did amazing stuff. Even in South England, I saw some work of his. Really transforming places.
Yeah.
And also being very, how to say it, I think that's what it is, you know, what does it mean, what would it mean, clairaudience?
What would it mean, what's
clairaudience, clairvoyance.
Yeah, yeah.
It's clairvoyance, you see, but clairaudience, you hear stuff. Mm-hmm. Does it mean you hear voices? You have people, you know, you have people who are completely oversensitized into electromagnetic waves and frequencies. People who cannot stand cell towers and stuff, you know, they get all these physical symptoms and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an oversensitivity then, and an imbalance. But where are those stories coming from in England, you know, about elementals and sensitivities and ley lines and all of that? We had those senses.
Yeah.
It was there. Yeah. How to say, in the Celtic tradition, how many stories? You know, I mean, and even in if you, how to say, do research in Ireland and stuff like this, to musicians, they listen to their stories. They all talk about something else coming through. So I think, how to say, in one way of making that cycle, we are at a wonderful point, actually, where you can say, in the jargon, you would say, yeah, there's a new portal opening. A new what do they call it, door of perception, which was always there, but I think behind the listening sense there is much more. And you know, for instance, anthroposophic people, or even in India now, I heard about it, they speak about 12 senses.
12 senses?
Yeah. Sense of warmth, sense of balance, sense of gravity, of density, and all of that.
Okay.
So I think that's what it is, because let's say we have this nomenclature in India, you have for every element, you have a sense. And the hearing is the highest sense of the ether element, and so. But I think that it's like a gateway into all the subtle senses, basically.
Okay.
Yeah, and you can say subtle senses means also to bring us possibly through that one open a new dimension of our perception of life. Hopefully so, because we've been, how to say, overly focused. You mentioned at one point the industrial evolution. Uh-huh. It was all, how to say, focusing on the mechanics and on the material happening of life.
Right. Yeah?
And in my perception, with most of the young people who are coming here, they want to break out of it. Or they have a sensibility and kind of like an inner knowing that there's something else. So how do we explore that dimension? One real way of doing it is through the sense of listening.
Okay.
But I mean listening in an extended sense, because I also speak about what we're really looking here is the touch of sound. You know, where the sense of listening, it's not only listening, you learn also perceiving. I think it's like refining the sense of perception.
I see. Yeah. Refining the sense of perception so that it fine-tunes the sound as well.
Yes, yeah, and sound is an entry into it. And there is no, okay, we have from the mystics, we have some how does it, way signs, and this is what's happening, there's this whole process of Nada Yoga, which kind of like lays it out, you go deeper and deeper and deeper into listening, and you will hear this one, and when you come to that stage, you might hear that quality and texture of sounds. Don't get stuck, continue the journey. Stuff like this, but I think that's part of the beautiful adventure, that there besides the mystic experience, that we're really there in front of an open gate and not yet sure what's coming for us, and that makes it exciting.